Can you imagine what it feels like to be a Canadian soccer player as Peter Pendergast blows the whistle? It's official. Canada 2000 Gold Cup champions. How does that sound?
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Peter Galindo and Thomas Neff.
It's episode 12 of the Northern Football Podcast. I'm Peter Galindo, joined by my fellow vaccinated brethren, Thomas Neff. How are you doing, sir?
Doing really well, Peter. Yes, vaccinated. So are you. Hopefully some podcasts in person this summer, if the circumstances allow it. Very jam-packed show for everyone. MLS teams had double fixtures this week. Also, two young guys doing things in England. Mm-hmm. Very historic things. TPL providing an update. Obviously, we answer your questions from Canucks Abroad, mailbag, and the poll. And we have news of our own.
Indeed, we do. Before I get to that, please don't forget to subscribe and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us at Northern Football on Twitter. And speaking of that news that Thomas just teased, we are proud to announce that we are partnering with FTF Canada. Are you a soccer player aged 15 to 18 years old? Are you looking to play at the university level in Canada or the United States? FTF Canada is holding combines for boys and girls this year and can get you connected to the scouts that can make your dreams come to life. Use the promo code NFP2021 for 10% off FTF Canada's combines for boys and girls. More info will be displayed in the podcast description as well.
And let's dive into the MLS as the Vancouver Whitecaps lost to Sporting KC 3-0. A truly sad week for the Vancouver Whitecaps, who collapsed to previously pointless Minnesota United 1-0 on Wednesday. They're getting trounced 3-0, staying in their winless run against them to 7 games. But the last few days have produced several questions regarding some of their Canadians, Peter.
That they have. And I think the first and most important Canadian that I think we have to mention is Lucas Cavallini, just because he's the most senior of the Canadian players in terms of, you know, national team importance and all that. He only has 1 goal in 6 games, and his numbers are down across the board, which kind of makes us wonder, should there be any concern? Obviously not right now, I guess, because not only is it early in the season, but Jonathan David, you would imagine, is going to get called up, which wasn't the case in March. And when you do look at his numbers in general, yes, he is averaging fewer expected goals, fewer shots, touches in the box. I think the one that's really, I think, very telling of his current form right now, Thomas, is that he's tripping over the ball a lot more when he has a lane to run into to get in towards goal. And he's averaging about 2 more turnovers per 90 minutes so far this year. I imagine part of this is Vancouver's struggling to, I suppose, create an open play still. And one way to solve this is to utilize the flanks, because as we saw against Minnesota, Cavallini had his best chances in that match when Vancouver utilized the width. I feel like this issue could correct itself, but there's certainly something to monitor, I think, for the next little bit. Would you agree with that?
Well, I want to expand the conversation on Lucas Cavallini, because the MLS released the salaries of every club. We'll get to that a little more in detail a little later. But Lucas Cavallini, highest paid player of Vancouver Whitecaps on the lowest spending team. That comes with certain expectation. Comes with certain expectation, pressure. 1 goal in 6 games just isn't going to cut it. Definitely is a worrying factor. For me, as you kind of hinted in previous episodes, you know, it's funny. He was actually asked by a reporter in the presser, have you changed to a midfielder? Because he hasn't been playing higher up the pitch as he is a center forward. So 1 goal in 6 games with the amount of wage that he's on. Do you think, Peter, that the Whitecaps can keep a player like that? I'm not really worried about his national team form. I think he'll come in and perform. But definitely his club form has to be some sort of concern.
Well, it does. But the problem is he's 28, 29 years old now. You spent $6 million in a transfer fee to sign him. He has that DP tag. So I feel like you're kind of saddled with him for now, because you're definitely not going to sell him for anywhere near that amount if you do want to offload him. I think talk about selling him in general is just too early, because we saw last year he was really struggling too. And then I think as he got a bit more form and matches and just everything else in general, and once all the Whitecaps got healthy, because they were dealing with a lot of injuries and absences in general, that's when we saw a lot of improvement. And he finished the year with pretty solid numbers overall, considering Vancouver was pretty much bottom of the league in every attacking metric. But the fact that he is being deployed so deep, because him, Caicedo, and Dahomey are being relied on to not only score the goals, but just getting the ball from point A to point B. And that is, in a lot of ways, hurting Cavallini's production. And if there isn't a change in that regard, that's when it could be troublesome.
Derek Cornelius got his first start coming back from injury. Andy Rose, Russell Tybert, not playing in this one. Kind of gives you the feeling, I guess, that when guys come back from injury, when Marto Santos has more options available to his disposal, the weaker players are just going to be losing their spot, and not only losing their spot, but rewarding the guys that are trying, that are doing things, and don't look lost out there.
Well, yeah. And I guess for Cornelius, it's just a case of, like himself, the rest of the team struggled. And he tends to perform at his peak with a veteran next to him. Just look at his national team performances, right? That's when he tends to really, really shine. And that's why I think Eric Godoy's return should help in this regard. But Cornelius and Ranko Veselinovic, I feel, offer you the same amount of pros as they do cons. And with Cornelius, he still needs to work on his composure in possession, particularly when he's pressed. And needs to fine-tune certain areas. He can sometimes misjudge aerials, sometimes gets out-strengthened in one-on-one duels, which I would not really expect. Sometimes he just kind of loses concentration with his positioning. And generally speaking, his positioning is quite solid, but that's when you kind of wonder, would playing in a settled back line with Godoy help in this case? And to that, I would say yes, because if you just look again at what he does for Canada, you can see that he can put it together. And he's 23, 24 years old. Like, he's still very young for a center back. He can put it all together. But what's imperative is that he gets a run of games, because I feel like he gets 5 or 6 in a row, and then as soon as he makes a mistake, he's dropped for weeks at a time, and that just hurts his development.
And two young guys, Ryan Raposo started in this one. Two questions. How do you think he did? And obviously, Baldissimo coming in last 35 minutes of the game must have given them a boost.
Oh, it absolutely did. Yeah. For Raposo, I felt sorry for him, just because that isn't really the role he should have been thrusted into, especially when you're changing the entire right side. I feel like he was being asked to do way too much, in that he had to provide width on the right. He had to come inside because Kansas City had 3 in the midfield. Vancouver only had 2, so they were overloaded right away. And then he had to protect Nowinski when he was getting overrun by Daniel Chaloui and Gadi Kinda on that right-hand side. I just felt like he was overwhelmed, and then Mark Dos Santos realized this isn't working. Why he didn't start Michael Baldissimo from the beginning, I don't know why. Because as soon as he came in, Thomas, like, it was night and day. He didn't misplace a single pass in the 12 minutes of the first half he played in. Ended up completing, I think, 26 or 29 of his passes in total. And that's when Vancouver had their best spells of the game, basically from the moment he came in until, I would say, maybe a few minutes before Alan Pulido made it 3-0. And then you look at the underlying numbers in general. Michael Baldissimo is averaging 0.82 expected goals build up per 90 so far this year. And that takes into account how much expected goals a player is involved in. That doesn't include him taking the final pass or shot in an attacking sequence. So it goes to show you that when Baldissimo's on the pitch, he's going to create something. And I think it's imperative that he does start from here on out. He's been fit since Wednesday after having a bit of an injury. and didn't start against Minnesota, didn't come in until they were 2-0 down against Kansas City. I don't understand why Mark Dos Santos doesn't give him more of a chance, because the team just clicks when he's on the pitch. And then you look at how Caio Alexandre, someone else who can also progress the ball forward, plays with him and kind of shoulders that burden, then it makes no sense why you wouldn't put him out there to provide a bit more control to your team, which desperately needs it. Otherwise, you're then relying on Maxime Crépeau, who, by the way, stood on his head again, to bail you out, and you just can't do that.
I was just about to ask you about Maxime Crépeau. We've said countless times, the guy has been lights out, sometimes even their best player. If he didn't have the performance that he had, he could have gotten ugly.
Well, yeah, for sure. And, I mean, it could have been 6-0 if it wasn't for him. Once again, the Whitecaps, defensively, they've been better this year. This was the first shellacking they have taken this year. You just hope that, kind of like what we saw in 2019 when LAFC beat them, I think it was 6-0 sometime in like June that year. That's when the wheels fell off the wagon for Vancouver. The hope here is that it doesn't affect them in the next few weeks, because we saw that mentally it just all dissipated for that team. And if that's the case again this year, then you have to wonder if Mark Dos Santos is under pressure, because keep in mind, he's not Axel Schuster's guy.
Christian Gutierrez, he's been electric up the field. But the last couple of games, his involvement in the attack has stalled. Do you think his development is being, his growth overall is being sort of stopped because he isn't getting involved in the attack? Because obviously we know that the modern fullback has to contribute you something off the pitch.
Well, Thomas, you know as well as I do, when he was playing in Chile, that's when he was able to, I think, highlight his effectiveness as a two-way fullback. And when you looked at how he played last year, when he got a few games here and there, he actually performed at his best when he was getting involved in the build-up. And I understand if you want to have a bit of balance to protect yourself against defensive transition, and you want to have Gutierrez as the more conservative fullback, and then have, provided he's fit and available, Gaspar as the more attack-minded fullback. But there's ways to utilize both, right? Michael Baldissimo is not going to push up if you start him. He can provide a bit of solidity to the defense and protect against counters if you want to push both fullbacks up. And I just feel like it limits not only Vancouver's attacking buildup, but also Gutierrez's potential and development if you don't use him to his full, or for his full attributes, really.
Sign up before we move on. Really quickly, 17-year-old Cameron Habibula received 25 minutes off the bench. He had some bright moments. Perhaps we see more of him this season. Now let's move on to Toronto FC. They picked up a 2-0 win against the newly rebranded Columbus FC. That was midweek, but they tied 1-1 against NYCFC at Yankee Stadium. Point lost or point earned?
I would say point earned, because you look at the general complexion of the game and NYCFC dominated it for probably 70-odd minutes. And then I think when the Bono dropkick bounced off of Jesus Medina's head and then into the goal, it was obviously ruled out because a head injury means you have to stop the play right away, which was the right decision. Toronto FC almost just thrived in the chaos that it caused. And if NYCFC was just a bit more disciplined in that regard, they might have not only gotten the win, they might have scored another goal. But I think in terms of, if you were to look at maybe the improvements in these two games, I mean, you have to say it starts with Jefferson Soteldo. The dynamism and improvisation he provides transforms that attack. The one knock you could have on him, and Thomas, having watched him, you could probably agree with me on this, he doesn't tend to shoot in quality positions. He kind of looks for the pass first, which in some situations is fine, but there were one or two moments in both games where he had a clear shot at goal and chose not to take it. But that to me was the one major difference. The only downside is that the strikers in Akinola and Altidore still aren't really latching onto many chances. And Akinola looks still, after the injury, a step slower. Maybe as he continues to play, that improves. He is starting to, I think, get his juice is flowing here and he's starting to get into good positions again. It's just about finishing them off now, really. And luckily, I guess, for DFC and that NYCFC game specifically, another Canadian did step up.
Right. I think Akinola has improved from game to game. Definitely doesn't look like the player he was last year. I mean, especially in the MLS, his back tournament that happened in Florida and in Disneyland. But he has been proving. And not only that, but when you have Josie Altidore, who is unavailable as many times as he is, Akinola, just how young he is, you know, in his early 20s, becomes that number one option as a number nine when Altidore isn't available, right? I'm going to disagree with you on the fact that a goal was earned. I think they could have gotten 3 points. I mean, Bono just keeps being the conversation for all the wrong reasons. I just don't know how long Chris Armas will be able to really keep going with Alex Bono as number one. This kind of mistakes not only cost you points, but cost your team morale, confidence, and quite honestly, like, yeah, points. I mean, still early on in the season. Obviously, the second half of the season will be more important, as there will be a lot more games. But the truth is, the standings are the standings. A good start is just as important as the rest. Yeah, I don't know. I just think that more or less you have to kind of consider the goalkeeping situation and I think the defensive which has improved somewhat.
Yeah, I suppose so. The reason TFC was able to get the draw, I mean, in terms of who scored the goal, was Jacob Schaffelberg, his first in MLS. And, you know, he's had the odd game or two in general where he has been a threat. Do you think this does enough to convince Chris Armas to give him more minutes, even off the bench? Or will it be just too difficult to displace Jefferson Soteldo, for example?
Now, I think Jacob Schaffelberg, I think with this goal, not only does he give himself a bigger chance to play a more minutes this year, but I think it gets him higher up the pecking order with the TFC forwards. Would you agree, Peter?
Yes, in terms of overall minutes, even if it's just coming off the bench, I think he's been the one Canadian wide player, or just Canadian forward even in general, if you don't want to include Akinola, I suppose, who's making things happen. I know some TFC fans might disagree, but, you know, I've liked him in certain moments. And when you look at, again, a very small sample size, he's the leading TFC forward in expected goals, in shots per, this is all per 90, expected goals per shot, expected assists, and he's tied for first among all TFC forwards for touches in the box with Jefferson Soteldo on 11. And both have played about the same amount of minutes so far, which kind of goes to show you just how dour it's been for TFC's attack thus far. So I think given the, you know, 100-odd minutes he's played so far, he's done enough with it for me to at least say, yeah, give him some more appearances off the bench, especially if he can do that.
When Chris Mavinga came back, we saw that the TFC had gained speed at the back, gained quality, and I think it's worked good for them. Now, the newly acquired Kamar Lawrence, do you think he's had the same effect?
Well, it's tough to say after the first start, but I think he looked decent and showed some flashes in terms of what a partnership between him and Soteldo could provide, which I guess could be good, because I think in order for Soteldo to reach his optimal impact, you need to have a fullback like Kamar Lawrence who will overlap and who will kind of draw out defenders and who will just in general play off of Soteldo. And then once Pozuelo comes back and he's fully fit, that could help too, of course. But yeah, it's just too early to say, really. But that being said, I thought that on both sides of the ball, he was solid enough, especially considering, you know, he hasn't played in MLS in a couple of years. But the good news for him, and I guess for TFC in general, he's used to the system Chris Armas likes to deploy, which is an added plus.
Now, moving on to CF Montreal, they lost 1-0 against Atlanta United, one of the best teams in Major League Soccer. It was a week of highs and lows for Montreal, who beat Inter Miami. James Pantemis, getting his first start this year, didn't have a lot to do. but he looked good.
He did. And when he's been in MLS or started in MLS, and even in the CPL when he was on loan there, he's performed to an average to above average level in a small sample when it comes to shot stopping. And that is always encouraging. He still has to work on his distribution, which, you know, we obviously saw during the Olympic qualifiers. That's still the case. And I think in general, he's getting decent command of his area and all those intangibles. The big problem here is, much like, you know, in Vancouver with the young goalkeepers they have there, they have a number one who's been lights out. Clément Diop has been terrific since claiming the number one job under Thierry Henry, and he's continuing it this year. Once again, terrific against Atlanta. And that's going to be the challenge for Pantemis, is just trying to outdo Diop in training, and then the odd appearance he gets, whether it's in the cup or whether it's the odd league game, to just take advantage of it and show, hey, Diop can rest for two or three games. I've got this.
I would be surprised if Pantemis isn't made Montreal's number one within at least 2 years. You're talking about a guy who's homegrown, won't count as much to the salary cap. And he has potential. He has a lot of potential. And he has a EU passport, being a dual national from Greece. So I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't get that look with Montreal. Maybe he tries his luck in Europe. Potentially, you know, one of those leagues that, you know, there is some sort of room for opportunity. Maybe not a too demanding league, but somewhere else. Come on, Miller. We spoke about him 2 weeks ago. He rebounded defensively after making that one mistake that cost the team some points.
Two, really.
What do you think his development has turned into? Obviously, shifting over from the left back to the center back, and obviously his use overall by Wilfred Nancy.
Well, I think it's like you said after the Vancouver loss. As long as he does well for like 5-6 games in a row, and then just has like the one odd mistake every now and then, you can stomach that. And that's probably what he's going to provide you. That's why I wasn't too concerned at the mistakes that he made, because look, defenders will make a rash challenge every now and then. It's just a part of the game. You're going to get beaten in the air, although I still think that's a weakness he has to work on. And it was once again a problem against Atlanta. But overall, yeah, I mean, I think he's developing nicely to the point where, as we have discussed ad nauseum on this podcast, he's probably still the favorite to retain that left center back spot as we kind of look at the qualifiers in a couple of weeks here. And the fact that he is getting minutes at a pretty high level only reinforces that. Even if it isn't a three at the back and they play in a four, then it's fine for me. And that, I suppose, is the good news, that for a defender who is still on the young side, who is learning a new position in a new team with new teammates all around him, that he's able to bounce back the way that he has.
Samuel Piet, I know we talk about him a lot, and the reason why we do is because he's a fundamental, not only with the Canadian national team, but also Montreal. Seems like he's been there forever, even though it wasn't the case, having gone to Europe at an early age. The guy has been an absolute beast this week. What were your thoughts on his return to the 11, to the lineup?
Oh man, that Miami game was ridiculous. The guy was everywhere. Like, I think he had, I can't even remember what the number was. It was like 15 recoveries. He completed close to 90% of his passes, had a couple of key passes in there. Like, he was doing it all. Now, Miami was terrible, which I think is a caveat that we should mention. But regardless, he hadn't been in the 11 for a couple of weeks. So to come right back in there in the sweltering humidity and to do what he did was really impressive. Even in the Atlanta game, where I think the level dropped a little bit, which is to be expected because they were playing a Gabriel Ainsay side who, you know, tends to control possession and move the ball very quickly, I thought he coped pretty well. And that bodes well for the midfield depth for Canada, because obviously Eustáquio is going to be ahead in the pecking order for most games, but man, you can't ignore Piet when he has games like that.
And talking about having strong games, Georgi Mihailovic, seems like he's bounced back from what was an odd performance earlier. Is he still a fundamental part of this team for you going forward? And what else do you think the rest of the season looks on from here, individually speaking, for him?
I think he's been a lot better the last two games. I think in midweek, he probably had his best game in a Montreal shirt in terms of chance creation and just pulling the strings in the final third. Maybe a little less so against Atlanta, but again, they controlled the vast majority of possession. That's going to happen. I really liked the combinations he was pulling off with Mathieu Chouinard and himself. I felt those two were connecting nicely. Obviously, Kyoto was getting involved too, as was Bjorn Janssen. And I think now that he's maybe settled in a bit more and knows the forwards' tendencies and just the overall team's tendencies, I think you're going to see his level keep rising, because when you popped under the hood and looked at the underlying numbers, it looked pretty solid. You just didn't see it completely with the eye test. But now he's being utilized further up the pitch on the ball, and you're starting to see the rewards being reaped by Montreal.
Now, there was a notable shift from Wilfred Nancy on Saturday. Lapanainen and Mathieu Chouinard, both as wing backs. Now, Chouinard is interesting because I've interviewed his brother and I've spoke to people that know him. He's falling off the radar, let's say, put it that way. He wasn't included in the U23 qualifying. And really, some people even thought he could have made the jump to the senior national team. Now, it all comes down to minutes. What do you think of him, and could we see him at the Gold Cup if he continues to play minutes over the course of the season?
I think so, yeah. And I think what was encouraging was, unlike Clément Baye, Mathieu Chouinard provided a bit more attacking vigor in the mold of Zachary Broguillard. Not completely the same, because Broguillard likes to get to the byline and cross the ball, whereas Chouinard in this game was cutting inside a bit, influencing the game in more central areas, was again, as I mentioned, combining with Mihailovic and Kyoto and Janssen, actually played his way through Atlanta's press a few times, quite seamlessly with his dribbling ability. I think for as long as Broguillard is out, I think Chouinard should be the go-to option if Nancy wants more attacking attributes from that right wing back. Now look, he did struggle defensively, no doubt about it. And that's bound to happen as he is primarily a winger. But if he can settle into that role, you can teach him certain defensive positioning, tell him when to lunge in, how to, you know, defend against a tricky winger like he was facing a lot of times against Atlanta, then I think he can be at the very least, a solid rotational option in that position. And right now, that really is his only option for minutes because, as we know, Montreal doesn't play with out-and-out wingers. So it's either train yourself as a wingback or somehow learn to become a number nine, which I feel is far less feasible than the former option.
The MLS made a surprising release late last week. For the first time in 2 years, they made the salaries public. These are the numbers. TFC spent $17.01 million, second in MLS. But it doesn't factor in Soteldo and Lawrence and the recently signed Dwyer, which surely would make them the top spenders again. Pozuelo and Altidore earn about half the payroll. That is crazy. Montreal clocks in at 12.6 million, which is just above the league average. Victor Wanyama is the top earner at just 3 million. I mentioned it there before. Vancouver is the league's lowest spender at just 8.7 million. Lucas Cavallini is the top earner at 1.3 million. In terms of the Canadians, Cavallini is the top earning Canadian player in MLS. The rest of the top 10 list is as follows. Second place, Jonathan Osorio with 876,000. Third, Samuel Piet, 454,000. Russell Tybert clocking in at 387,000. Teshua Kandele, 290,000. Maxim Crepeau, 277,000. Balu Tabla, 276,000. He's cashing in big.
Yes.
Mark Anthony Kai, 247,000. Rich Larea, 226,000. And Zach Broguillard at 203,000. Obviously, all these numbers are in US dollars, not Canadian.
Yeah.
Wow, a lot of thoughts. What surprised you the most from a Canadian perspective regarding all these salaries, and then maybe about the clubs as well?
Well, I mean, in terms of the clubs, really no shock. Vancouver's always been at the bottom. Montreal's usually been in the middle, and Toronto's always been at the top since the Jovinko days. So,
agreed. Yeah,
nothing really changed in that regard for me. But in terms of the players, really the big shocks in terms of, I think, who's undervalued when it comes to their wages. And look, obviously, this is not exactly what they make, because it takes targeted allocation money, the bonuses, and just sort of averages it out into an annual guaranteed compensation. So guys might make a bit more, they might make a bit less, depending on those bonuses. But for me, Marc-Anthony Kay and Maxime Crépeau making $247,000 and $277,000 respectively is incredible value. And if I'm a European team, and also Richie Larea making $226,000 is nuts. Now I understand he was a bit of a late bloomer in MLS, and he only just earned like a proper quote-unquote contract, but that's a terrific number to have him on if you're TFC. But if I'm European clubs and I see Kay's wages and Larea's wages, and obviously both have been linked to Europe in recent months, then I see that as a massive opportunity to be able to get them in terms of wages on the cheap. Because relatively speaking, you know, a club like Besiktas or a club in the English Championship or, you know, any other comparable could pay you double and really not blink an eye, and it wouldn't make too much of a dent on their wage bill. And they'd still be making pretty decent money playing overseas, which is great for them. The one sort of stunner for me in terms of, like, I guess a negative connotation, if you want to call it that, is Jonathan Osorio making just under $900,000, which I'm pretty sure was signed after his really out of nowhere 2018 campaign, where he scored double digit goals. And, you know, obviously he cashed in on that because there was interest from overseas. Look, I'm not as high on Osorio as other people are, and I don't think he's a bad player by any means. I think he has value, but $900,000 in a cap league for a glue guy, in my eyes, is quite a hefty price to pay, in my opinion. I don't know what you think about any of this, but those are my thoughts.
I disagree with you on Osorio. I mean, the guy had an unbelievable year in 2018, being the CONCACAF Champions League MVP. So that contract is based on after that season. So based on that season alone, I think the wages, there is merit there. Samuel Piette, I think, should be making more money. Although when he did sign a contract after the Gold Cup in 2017, and then that included club options, the rest of the players, I mean, Balu Tamba, wow, making a lot of money for being involved as little as he is. And I agree with you on Marc-Anthony Kay and Richie Larea. I mean, for Kay, look, I mean, English championship clubs were interested in him a year or 2 years ago. And if you're an English championship club, I mean, $247,000, that's like, that rounds up to £180,000. A year. I mean, that's incredible value, and not only incredible value, but that's literally what they pay their backup goalie over there.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's incredible in that sense. And Richie Larea, I mean, he was the talk of conversation. Seems like Besiktas is becoming the clubs of the Canadians, but he was interested there. I mean, the Turkish Super League pays a lot more than what he's earning at Toronto FC. But I also wouldn't be surprised if TFC sign him to a lengthy extension. As far as the rest of the Canadians go, Russell Tybert, yeah, making a lot of money considering his drop in quality. And Tesh Hakandeli, I think he's been a guy that, from a Canadian perspective, he's sort of been out in the shadows for good reason, obviously. You have Cavallini, you have David, you have Davies, you have Laren, and then you have a crop of young players coming through. A lot of them are dual national, so you have to give them priority. But Tesh Hakandeli, to me, I think he still adds value to the national team. And obviously, I think when he was with FC Dallas and now with Orlando City, the guy isn't a superstar in his team by any means, but he's still a good player to have in your team.
Listen, man, we can't get into it now, but I really want to have that Osorio debate with you about his value and all that, but we just don't have the time. So that'll be for another day.
The Northern Football Podcast are proud partners with FTF Canada. Are you a soccer player aged 15 to 18 years old? Do you have a child aged 15 to 18 years old who has aspirations of playing soccer at a higher level? FTF Canada can get you connected to the scouts that can make your dreams come to life. Use the promo code NFP2021 for 10% off all boys and girls combines. You can find out more info on ftfcanada.ca.
The CPL, there was news in terms of their season delay. They're targeting a mid-June or early July start to the 2021 season in one location. So Thomas, you had mentioned Newfoundland or Manitoba as possibilities for, you know, just the neutral locations, the one locations. Are those still the favorites at this point? Like, what are you hearing about this whole thing?
Well, I haven't followed up on the update as far as that goes. However, in my opinion, I think it should be Newfoundland. I think in terms of cases, in terms of infrastructure there. And yes, it is quite far, but I mean, you have Western as a sponsor. So, I mean, that shouldn't be too much of an issue. I think just considering how well it worked in PEI last year, I think it could be a massive success in St. John's. I wouldn't be surprised if Victoria and Halifax isn't off the table. I mean, I don't think they're counting it out just yet. Mm-hmm. However, I do think Manitoba looks very unlikely, considering their surge in COVID-19 cases. I think it has to be said, Peter, 28 games. That's massive. I mean, I never understood, and I guess we never really got an answer from Commissioner David Klanick in last year, but 7-game season. I mean, yikes. That was way, way too low of a number, not only in terms of from a perspective thing, maybe clubs looking to sign some players, but 7 games is just too small of a sample size for anything, really. I just don't know how you can fire a coach or let go of a player just based on a 7-game season. But anyways, I mean, that's football. That's the world of professional sports, and every team had to make changes. But yeah, I mean, I think it's super positive, the 28 games that they're trying to aim at. Now, it looks like the CPL in their update said that they're going to start in one location, but as they're eyeing in the fall, they're eyeing a return to stadiums, you know, returning to home markets,
yep,
in venues. Do you think that is possible, considering the current vaccination rates?
I think it is very possible. I mean, BC's talked about having fans in indoor arenas, let alone outdoor, in the fall. So I understand that projections can change, and this virus is obviously unpredictable because it's a freaking virus. This is what it does. But I think it's fairly optimistic. It just depends at what point in the fall, right? Because if it's, you know, end of October, early November, the CPL season would be just about ending. So it's, you know, or will be ending. So at that point, it would be no use. And I mean, even though the provinces are talking about a quote unquote close return to normality in July and August, I just don't think it's going to be enough to get fans in. And that is really going to be the crutch of the CPL's argument, I feel, is we need to have fans in stadiums.
Well, I recently watched an interview from the medical chief officer, and they said if they get 75% of the population vaccinated, fully vaccinated, by September, and obviously ICUs, deaths, number of cases go down, all of that goes down, and almost herd immunity is sort of reached, then there is that talk of events with crowds that could emerge. And as you said before, I mean, this virus is so unpredictable. But I do agree with you that it does depend on when that will be reached, because if it's in September, then yeah, you can play 2 months in one location and the other 2 months in stadiums. But, you know, if it's in October, November, maybe you could do two legs, a home and an away. Obviously, pending the weather and whatnot. But it's definitely an interesting development, and I hope that they're allowed. I mean, at the end of the day, how many times have we said it's super important? I mean, yes, CPL has a 10-year, not a 10-year clause, but obviously it's a league that depends on financial reimbursement per se. That after 10 years of investors, the ownership groups, they have to get some sort of return, or at least break even, in order for the league to happen and go on after.
Maybe just to close out the CPL talk, Forge FC, they signed center back Dejan Jakovic on a free transfer. He recently played with LAFC. Now, with this news, and obviously the Joe Mason signing that Cavalry made the other week, would you still say that Mason is the signing of the year, or would you say that Jakovic would usurp that, obviously considering we haven't played matches yet?
I think two things to consider here. The age factor. Jakovic is older than Mason. That's one thing. The other thing is considering Jakovic last played last year as opposed to Mason. The League One season goes until the end of May. So he's in fitness. He's playing games. I think Jakovic, the best Canadian signing. Mason, the best internationals.
We will shift over to some Canadians abroad chat. So much to get into, because we did make our poll based on what happened over the weekend. And we asked you guys, the listeners, which of these two Canadian debutants in the Premier League are you most excited about? Is it Theo Corbenou of Wolves or Daniel Jevison of Sheffield United? And as of the time of recording, 116 votes have been cast. 72.4% of you said Corbenou, which I'm kind of surprised by myself. But a comment from Pascal Pelletier at Shovel Third on Twitter said that this is almost an unfair question, but that's why we asked it. Of course, fans are going to be enamored by both players. It's just about which one excites you the most. Thomas, maybe before we get into that, are you surprised at how the poll turned out? Could it be because Corbenou is already capped and Jevison's international future is still uncertain, so Canadians don't want to get burned by him?
100% it is. Corbenou has played for Canada already, and you know he made 8 Premier League bench appearances. I think it has to do with that. I mean, the game of Corbenou in the March window was amazing. I think he had a lot of really good chances, a lot of touches. But you cannot ignore what Jevison has done. I mean, he's been superb. And he is the youngest player in Premier League history to score in his first professional start.
Yeah.
And against Everton, a team that is not only has superstars like James Rodriguez and a world-class manager in Ancelotti, but his stock is rising, and obviously considering how Jevison is younger than Corbenou, his potential looks to be higher. But I definitely do think I'm surprised still by the poll.
Yeah, maybe also Sheffield United going down has a lot to do with it too, because Corbenou will at least be contracted to a Premier League club next season, whereas Jevison will be, provided he doesn't leave, will be in the Championship. But that could also give him more opportunities. So we'll see about that. Speaking of Corbenou, as we dip into this week's mailbag, we received a question from Ken MNT Opinions at Sad Since 86. Do you see Theo Corbenou being loaned out next season? Thomas, what say you?
I do. I really think that Corbenou will find it tough to find minutes, consistent minutes at Wolves. There's probably as good of a chance, if he does play for Wolves, that it'll be, you know, coming off the bench, 10, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, maybe the odd start here and there. But in terms of regularity, I think I would much rather see him start game in, game out at a championship club. I think that would be great for his development. For example, when Liverpool loaned out Liam Miller to Charlton, they included a clause in his contract that Miller had to play a certain amount of minutes. Otherwise, Charlton would be penalized. I think that you can make the same case in terms of the contract.
Well, for sure. But I don't really mind where Corbinou goes because, look, when you look at the, literally it was 11 minutes, I totally understand this, so it's hard to draw complete conclusions. But even when I watched him with the under-23s all year, it's clear he needs to improve his strength, whether it's on the ball or off the ball. And one way to do that is alone to the championship or even to, say, the Bundesliga or a similar league where he can play game in, game out, where the pace is high, the intensity is high, and he can work on that. That's a very easily improvable attribute, is your strength. So that's the good side. But it's clear that Wolves probably won't give him the minutes he needs, and they'll probably end up making some signings during the summer to bolster the attack, because Jorge Mendes runs that club, so why would he not bring in some players? And it'll just make it a lot tougher for Corbinou to crack the 11. So why not give him a loan to a club where he'll play every week and then also improve tenfold on top of that? We also got another question from Ken MNT Opinions. He asked, any possible news on a Kyle Larin transfer? And then FPL Toronto, David, Kyle Larin is the name that keeps coming up for me. Any thoughts on a move, England or maybe Italy, France? What's next for him? Thomas, obviously he's been linked to two or three Premier League clubs. I think there were Saint-Étienne links in Ligue 1 in January. What do you see happening for Larin after he claimed the Turkish Super League with Beşiktaş over the weekend?
I think he will go to the Premier League, and I think it has to do a lot with his asking price. I just don't know how many Serie A clubs or Ligue 1 clubs could afford him, because obviously Beşiktaş wants at least 30 million euros. And it has to go without saying, but at the end of the day, there is sort of that situation of risk and reward where only so many clubs can afford to buy players for that price, but then maybe those clubs already have established forwards as opposed to smaller clubs that can't afford those players. Like, for example, if Larin went to a side like Newcastle, I think he would have much more opportunity than per se a club like West Ham or Everton or Tottenham for that matter.
Look, I think it's a foregone conclusion he'll go to the Premier League if he gets sold, provided Beşiktaş gets what they want. And it's interesting because it looks like Everton is going to sell Moise Kean to PSG, and they're looking for about 45 to 50 million euros for him, which will free up funds for a potential Larin deal. Now, if he does go to England, that would be my ideal landing spot for him just because of the Ancelotti factor. I wrote about this in my last mailbag, and all the reasons are on there if you guys want to check it out at petergalindo.wordpress.com. At West Ham, I don't think he would be able to operate in the exact same way he has at Beşiktaş this season. He won't be able to shadow into the box. He won't probably get the freedom to drift inside as much. And David Moyes wants his forwards to be able to hold up the ball, battle with defenders. Kyle Larin doesn't really do that, especially now. Everton, where Carlo Ancelotti is very tactically flexible, he can fit in different pieces to work into an 11. I think that could work, even though Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison would be ahead of him in the pecking order for the forwards. But all three of them could play together. I'm sure Ancelotti could find a way. I just think a jump to France would be the best stepping stone for him in terms of just the overall package, fit, minutes, playing quality in general, because I have my doubts if he could actually do well in England. But if he were to go anywhere, Everton would be my choice for him if I was in his entourage, as it were. Moving over to a question from Craig Kennedy at Craig Kennedy. A tough end of the road for Hoylett in Cardiff. Where do you guys see him next, and why can't it be TFC on some sort of TAM deal? Thomas, you and I talked about this a bit last week, but could you see him coming to TFC at some point?
I could, but as I said last week, I think it's more likely that he stays in England. It was recently reported that Hoylett could be reuniting with his former manager, Neil Warnock, at Middlesbrough. I think that would be a great fit for him. I think that's an environment that not only he can thrive at, but play week in, week out, and be valued and be played in the right position. So I think because of the surge of the young Canadians, I think Hoylett's place in the national team could be not in danger per se. Everyone knows that his credibility and everything. I'm sure Herdman has him, you know, has him listed, you know, for the cycle. But definitely, I think he has to at least be playing week in, week out to be included in every single call.
Just quickly, a question from Jay Fitzsimmons at Jay Fitz Soccer. Has Kadisha Buchanan fully recovered from her injury to be fit for the Olympics? Yes, she should be ready for the Olympics, barring a late injury. She hasn't played Lyon's last two games, but she's been on the bench in those matches and was starting and or playing pretty regularly for the last month and a half. So it seems like everything's fine fitness-wise. It's just a matter of will she pick up another knock before that, but should everything go fine? Yes, she should be ready. And then Vince Alvarado at Vince by Demand asked, I'd love to know more about Steven Simpson at Barnsley. I noticed he was on the U23 provisional roster for Olympic qualifying. Barnsley actually in action today in their promotion playoff semifinal. They lost 1-0 to Swansea, so a bit of an uphill climb for them. Really all that can be said about Steven Simpson right now is that he's been placed on the quote-unquote retained list as a player who has either been kept at the club or offered a contract to stay. He joined in October of 2020 after a strong trial, started four games for the under-23s, but has otherwise been on the periphery. 21-year-old forward who perhaps could make an impression next season, especially if Barnsley don't go up to the Premier League. Maybe he'll be able to crack his way into the team with a strong preseason or something of the sort. As we dive into maybe some other matters, things making news involving Canadians abroad this week, we do have to discuss Daniel Jebison's full debut after his goal. Before we get into maybe some interesting nuggets that you picked up, Thomas, what did you think of his performance as a whole, especially getting that decisive goal for Sheffield United in that win over Everton?
Aside from the goal, obviously they're on paper at least, there's always that worry of Premier League, U23 to the Premier League. There's a high jump in quality. On paper, it seems that way. But he didn't really look out of place besides the goal. It's really too bad that Sheffield are going to be relegated, as you mentioned earlier, to the Championship. But hey, I mean, that could work in his favor at the same time. Next season, he could be playing week in, week out. And after that, then he can make even a bigger jump if a club comes in and makes a very intriguing offer that Sheffield just can't refuse.
Yeah, very true. Look, I mean, obviously scoring the goal is excellent for him. He ended up finishing the game with three shots, 0.89 expected goals, and looked decent, all things considered. Look, just like Corbinu, he still needs to gain strength and polish his touch a little bit, but my God, the distance he covers and the tenacity he has off the ball, pressing the opposition, just like with the under-23s when I watched him there, very impressive, and I think notably, he's seemingly improved his anticipation in the box as seen on the goal. He kind of had issues timing the run with the pass, especially whipped passes into the box. It looks like he might have actually made some strides in that department, which is really promising for his development, especially at the age of 17, because if he can find a way to get into position to score just like that, he is going to be quite an impactful player, to say the least. Thomas, you spoke to one of his former youth coaches over the weekend, actually.
Yeah, I did. And I learned a lot, which is, you know, really a great story of sacrifice, a lot of hard work that, you know, doesn't really get told. But so obviously being born and raised in Oakville, Jebison would drive with his parents couple of hours, four times a week to King City. When he was younger, he actually got a chance to go to France for some tournaments. Interesting enough, he was actually scouted by Everton, but youth coach at the time did not sign him. Interesting how that played out.
Yep.
His family lives in Derby. Older brother actually tried out for Wolves, and his middle brother has played for Canada's U16. As far as a senior call-up on June, do not know if he will accept the call-up. We'll have to wait for that call-up to come in, which I'm sure it will. We'd be surprised if it didn't. But I think it can't be downplayed, the fact that He is already in the English system, and in England, everyone's talking about him. And in Canada, it's the complete opposite. I think those are the main points of information that I picked up. And TFC, they're monitoring him as well right now.
There you go. I mean, look, anytime you have a situation like this, where a dual national just explodes onto the scene, and he's already in the system of another country, you're going to have people just panicking into overdrive, being like, oh my God, what are the chances he plays for Canada? Is this going to happen? As happened over the weekend in my mentions, every time I would tweet about him, people would be asking me, oh, is he going to play for Canada? Could he accept the call up? Hopefully that kind of answers it a little bit. It probably is still quite murky in terms of the situation, but switching over to other matters, Kyle Larin and Atiba Hutchinson are champions. Besiktas nearly blew it in the end, but Kyle Larin did draw the decisive penalty against Göztepe, with Rashid Ghazal converting the winner to clinch the club's first title since 2017. And they also qualify for the Champions League playoff as a result, which could be huge for their finances as they are struggling financially right now. Thomas, we talked about Larin, so let's pivot to the ageless wonder known as Atiba Hutchinson. It's his third league title with Besiktas, and at 38 years old, he had another amazing season. Pivotal games for Canada coming up in, especially June. I doubt he'd be at the Gold Cup in July, but how would you handle him in terms of his national team commitments next month?
I think I would bring him in June, as you mentioned, and I would play him not in the first game against Aruba, definitely in the two leg against what will likely be a matchup against Haiti, and the game against Suriname. I would bring him on the bench. I would bring him off the bench with Eustáquio and Piet starting. If they decide to go with two midfielders in the middle, maybe Arfield, maybe Kai. Maybe Osorio comes in. We'll have to see. Yeah, I mean, look, I watched an interview from Herdman back in March, and when he talked about Hutchinson, two things stood out to me. One, this guy doesn't train a lot. Trains a couple of days before match, and then he plays, and then recovers. And it's been
nuts.
Incredible, right? Which is amazing. I know, it's incredible how he... And I had to rewatch the interview several times, and I couldn't believe it. But hey, I mean, when you have that kind of quality and that kind of expertise, you know what to do in that 2-3 training sessions, play the game, and then recover for the rest of the time. So I definitely do think, as I said there, I think have the first game off, second game, bring him on for 30-40 minutes, and start both games. Although I just don't know if he'll make it for those four games. Obviously, the Besiktas will be off in the summer and have a preseason in July. But at the same time, that's four games, a total of 360 minutes. And I think with Atiba, it's about load management. And quite frankly, I don't think you need him against Aruba.
No, we definitely don't. I agree with you. Play him against Suriname. Play him in the second round. Tell Atiba after that, all right, thanks for your hard work here. Enjoy your summer. And we'll see you possibly in September, because the man is an ageless wonder. As I mentioned, he defies everything I have come to know about life itself, and we must clone Atiba Hutchinson at all costs. Over in France, Jonathan David and Lille didn't clinch the title after a 0-0 draw with Saint-Étienne. Lille remain 1 point ahead of PSG entering the final match day. Lille will play already safe Angers, so they could probably wrap up the title then. Daniil Henry scored in midweek for Suwon, but then had to replace the injured Daewon Park after 30 minutes in the team's draw with Ulsan Hyundai. So obviously getting some minutes still is Daniil Henry. And then in MLS, very quickly, Thomas, Dane St. Clair has been dropped for two straight games at Minnesota United after some questionable errors in the build-up to those two games. Should there be cause for concern here from a Canadian perspective?
Yeah, there 100% should be. I mean, goalkeeper is a position that you don't just flip-flop game to game. You go with the hot hand. You go with the number one at the time. It's unfortunate. He let in, the truth is, he let in four goals in the opening game, and then he let in a goal that he didn't dive for against Austin. Although I did see some positives that Pantemis did start that one game against Inter Miami. But yeah, I do think it's probably going to be a while till he gets his chance, because Tyler Miller has been very good for Minnesota.
and Tejon Buchanan, second half substitute for the New England Revolution, and Liam Fraser made his Columbus debut off the bench in a 1-0 win for New England. Neither one of them really made much of an impact. Mark Anthony Kay, speaking of him, he looked excellent again for LAFC in their 2-0 loss to the Seattle Sounders. Really rough start for LAFC this season, by the way. I think they're near the bottom, if not at the bottom, of the Western Conference. And Jay Chapman was a substitute over the weekend for Inter Miami, but he's been starting most games and has been pretty good in those games, which is a nice change of pace for him, I am sure. Maybe a potential sleeper call-up in June and July, we will find out.
Sam Adekube, who we mentioned last week, he ended up not getting sold to Russia because his club, Vålerenga, didn't find a replacement for him. However, that still doesn't mean he could be sold when the European transfer window opens up as the Norwegian closed off. And finally, I did speak to someone close to Stefano Stacchio, and I'm told that besides all the reports that I've gone through with Porto, he hasn't actually put pen to paper.
Okay. All right. And then closing this out with some national team news. Canada will play its Gold Cup group stage matches at Children's Mercy Park in Kansas City. And we missed this last week just because it was so jam-packed, but their qualifier in June against Suriname will be played in Chicago. The Aruba match 4 days prior on June the 4th will be in Bradenton, just like the first two matches were. So yeah, there is going to be a lot happening in June and July. And thank you everyone for listening. Once again, we will speak to you same time, same place next week.